tonight to give you rules this weekend on how thou shalt act in relation to your parents, brothers and sisters and friends. And I could just sit here and read those rules off. And then you'd apply them to these, and that's what we would do. Problem with this, besides the fact you wouldn't listen to me, the other problem would be whenever we have rules that are set on how we are supposed to behave in order to be good, we find loopholes. So you can get around the rule and still be good. I had a friend in high school who was part of a religious group that said you cannot eat meat on Friday. And I remember when we were out on Thursday night, he could not eat meat after midnight. So if we went to a hamburger place in Los Angeles after 12 o'clock, he would simply set his watch back. You know, then it was as long as it was still Thursday. That's what we do when we have rules, right? Has anybody ever done anything like that? Okay, the other way, and that's what I'd like to, the way I'd like to approach that, the time we have together is this. It would be first to figure out an identity. And my ring. Identity would be just to first say, who are we? And then out of understanding who we are, then we know how out of that identity our behavior towards other people flows. Example, my last name is Erlander, and I have two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother, and we are very close. We are a very close-knit family. I grew up in a family that had somewhat of a contrast between very strict rules that we had to follow, and at the same time, we were very close and did a lot of laughing. And I don't know how those went together, but somehow they did. And one of the things we had was there are certain Erlander ways of behaving. You know, it isn't because way out there in the sky someplace there's a rule that says, but it was just not Erlander to do certain things, or it was Erlander to do certain things. It was from our identity. Do you understand? You could give examples from your family. One of ours was, I grew up before there were any McDonald's or anything like that, and we went to the Dairy Queen. And the Erlander way was you could only have a 5-cent ice cream cone unless you were celebrating. So on a normal time, it was always a 5-cent ice cream cone. It's still very hard for me to go to Dairy Queen now without getting a 40-cent ice cream cone? Now it's a little one. Because you know, that's Erlander. But then after a piano recital, then we got the biggest sundae at the Dairy Queen. That was Erlander. Remember Fiddler on the Roof? And Tevye there saying, when people ask him, why do we do things the way we do, what was his answer? Tradition, right? We could sing it together. You can picture him walking across the stage just singing tradition. And really what he was saying is that we have an identity. We are Jewish. We are a Jewish community, and this is the way Jewish people act. And we really don't worry about where it came from. We just do it because this is who we are. And that was a beautiful point in that movie. And I hope this weekend we can apply that in a way to who we are. Okay, now I'm going to start out this sessions with what, when I initially state it, will seem boring. And when I say this, I want it to sound boring to you because what I'm going to say is what might sound boring, I am going to place the task upon myself to have maybe 10 people at the end of these sessions say what I'm now going to say is the most exciting thing in life. That'll be my goal. I won't find out who the 10 people are, might be even 12. Might be all of you, that would be a dream come true. But I'm going to ask this question, who are we? I'm going to state something that probably has happened to almost everybody here that we all have in common, and that is this, that at one time in our lives and in your life, you went probably in the church before a pastor, and maybe you were a baby, and either water was sprinkled on you, poured on you, dumped on you, or you were dipped in water, or maybe as an adult you were dunked or climbed in the water and came out. Whatever it was called baptism. Right, baptism.
Who are we?
Baptized. And first I'll tell you the problem I have in talking about this to you, that I would be willing to bet that this is not the hottest topic among high school students. Am I right? How many of you ever get up in the morning and say, I can't wait to get to school to talk to my friends about our baptism? Has anybody ever said that? Okay, that's where we are. And my task now is in this time is to create interest for you so much that you might even go and ask your parents, what day was I baptized? And that day might be a celebration when you realize the meaning of this day for you. But just to start focusing our minds on this, let's take 20 seconds. And the reason I say 20 seconds is usually doesn't take very long. Turn to the person next to you or find, kind of get in twos, and then between the two of you, pass it back and forth. Tell that person everything you know about your baptism. Okay, I'll give you 20 seconds. Everything you know. Do you want 10 more seconds? Are you doing fairly well? Okay, 15 more seconds. Go ahead. I will have a 1 minute, this will be kind of a free-for-all time for the next minute, and that is called Everybody That Didn't Bring a Bible, if you would just run and get one off of the shelf there. Okay, this is a... It's about half. And those of you who have Bibles, if you look up Romans 6. You can get the New Testament. There's New Testaments over there too. And look up the 6th chapter of Romans. Romans 6. That's a hymnal. Yeah, Romans 6. What you to do now is there's really... When the scriptures are read, there's really two ways that scriptures are read and listened to. One I call dead and one I call living. Dead is when the words are dead and they're not alive and they don't speak to you. Living is somehow when those words actually enter into your life and kind of crash in, or either crash in or sneak in the back door. One thing we do a lot of times here at Holden, and when people have asked me to describe in one sentence what it's like to be at Holden Village for a whole year, I say it's like a combination of a continuing party and being a monk in a monastery at the same time. If you can imagine that. We're either going to parties or we're going to Vespers. So what I'd like to ask you to do, let's take about a few seconds and just be silent. And during that period of silence, try to center in and prepare. Think of yourself now as a vessel that's ready to receive the words. And then we'll take just 5 seconds, maybe that's all it takes sometimes to center down. And then I'll read from Romans 6, the first 4 verses. Let's have a moment of silence. Then, should we continue to live in sin so that God's grace will increase? Certainly not. We have died to sin. How can we go on living in it? For surely you know that when we were baptized into union with Christ Jesus, we were baptized into union with his death. By our baptism, then, we were buried with him and shared his death, in order that just as Christ was raised from death by the glorious power of the Father, so also we might live a new life. Let's look at the first verse. Most of you, I think, have the RSV. Would someone read, if you have the Black Bible, or the, what is the first verse? How does it read? Someone real loudly. Okay, now I want to tell you the argument that Paul is answering here. Paul preached that we are acceptable people in the kingdom of God, not because we're good, but because we're accepted or forgiven or loved by God. And now some people didn't like this. They said you have to work your way in. And their argument was this, and see if you can follow this argument. Coming to the Apostle Paul. And so the verse we just read here is Paul's answer to this argument. And what he really says, impossible. Impossible. Because when you're baptized, you be like the person that you were one with. You think, well, then, it's just impossible. If you and Jesus are really one, connected to each other, you are grafted into him, well, then you don't really talk like that. Because there's love there, and you'll want to live the way he lives.
And what Paul ties that to is baptism. Now, see if you can imagine from this verse what baptism was like for these early Christians. Verse 3, you know when we were baptized into union with Christ, we were baptized into his death. By our baptism then, we were buried. What kind of baptism do you think they're probably talking about? How would you be buried in baptism? Would it be one drop of water back there? Okay, you'd probably go all the way in the water, and what that meant is like you're dying. And then you come out of that water. I was baptized on February 6, 1939. And every year on that day, I think the most important thing that ever happened to me was this day. I was connected to Christ. I was embraced by Christ. I became the very part of the life of Christ. I became part of the very body of Jesus. Part of, I think, getting excited about baptism is to discover the early church. Because for the early church to go into the water of baptism very likely meant your death, because Christians were persecuted, they were tortured, and they were killed. And your decision to be baptized was that decision. So right now I'd like to show about 12 slides. And what the slides represent is an attempt, and if you ever would go to the city of Rome, you could try to do this. In the midst of the modern city of Rome, if you know where to dig, I don't know if any are here are interested in archaeology. Archaeology is digging under the present to find the past. And early Christian digging is exciting because I'm digging for my ancestors in the faith. The people that believed in Jesus 2,000 years ago, can I find what they left? And if I find what they left, I maybe can find what baptism meant to them. And so that's what I... Yeah, Bob, I can turn it on from down here. Projector makes noise for the first minute or so, but... What we have here is a model of the city of Rome as it would have looked in the first century. And this model was built by Mussolini at the time of the Second World War. For example, do you see the Colosseum there? That's the this massive amphitheater. That would be maybe in the model about 1 foot tall. And what you have here is this massive amphitheater. This is a wall of this is the aqueduct in ancient Rome. This is what called the circus, if you saw Ben-Hur, chariot races. This is where the Roman emperor lived, his palaces. This was the Forum, the place of the Roman government. And this is where, as I mentioned, were chariot races. The common people sat here, the Roman emperor and his party would sit here to watch the chariot races. That's what happened here. Then in here you would have the gladiators fighting, killing each other. You would have even navy battles. You would have animals killing people. And you can just imagine 55,000 people would be here screaming for more blood. Gives you an idea of those days. This is what would have been a typical Roman house in the first century. When you're there, you realize that many, many people were very wealthy. This would be the center of the home. And in every home, there was a little worship center where you would have your gods, and you would bring offerings and cereal and pray to these gods, always with the idea that the gods then would bring you good fortune. Is the blackboard in anybody's way? Are you looking over it okay? Okay. Yeah, now the Roman circus that you saw in the first picture, this is how it looks today in the modern city of Rome. Sometimes we think that the persecution of early Christians meant that if you're a Christian and you were martyred or you were killed for your faith, it was a great act of being a hero. But it was not, because what we know about early Christians, the killing of Christians was so boring that at the circus they would do it during the halftime when everybody steps out like for a hot dog or for to go to the bathroom. That's when they would kill Christians. And part of the reason it was so boring, they never fought back. There was never any sport in it. This is the inside of the Roman, or it's called amphitheater. And you can imagine, again, the thousands of people cheering in here. And every year they would get more dramatic things going here. And the theme was always violence. The Roman Empire was a violent society. And therefore, in the games here, you always portrayed violence and blood, and people loved it and they wanted more. The most spectacular thing that happened here is they would flood the whole bottom area. They would have actual navy battles between ships, and people could actually see wars going on down here and people killing each other. Or seeing your favorite gladiator, slave person, killing another gladiator. The emperor at the time of the first great persecution of Christians was Nero. And the story says that part of his entertainment was he had chariot races at night, and he would light the circus with the fires of burning Christians. He would line Christians around the edges, burn them, and from their fires he could have chariot races. This is the center today of what was then the Roman Forum, the center of the most powerful government in the world of that day. This was part of the grounds of where the Roman emperor lived. Here in this place, in the little museum, we have one of the first indications of the Christian community in the first century. What we have here, and I'm sorry the slide is up a little too high. Bob, are you up there? Are you? Oh, you could just prop that projector up and lower it. This is a copy of what is found in the bathroom or the latrine of the slaves of the Roman emperor. And what it is a picture of Jesus on the cross with the head of an ass. And then here's a Christian here worshiping this. And then this was a way of making fun of an early Christian. Because the saying, if you read it, it goes, Alexamenos worships his God. And what you have here is Alexamenos was a slave Christian of the first century, and the other slaves laughed at him because he worshiped a God who was crucified, which to the ancient world was a laugh. This is another, I think I will move that. In every house up on the second floor were the slave quarters. And this slave was a Christian, probably. And he had a secret panel behind another picture that he would take off in secret, and there would be a cross. Another indication of our ancestors in the faith in the first century. The Christians met in the catacombs, these tunnels under the city of Rome where they buried their dead. We see the symbols of Christ, the dove of peace, the Cairo. Here's a picture of Jesus standing with Daniel and Susanna, Old Testament heroes who died or persevered for their faith. And these Old Testament figures that were so faithful were an encouragement to the first century Christians to be faithful. Here's a picture of Holy Communion that was painted on the wall of a catacomb. Okay, we're back now to the model of the city of Rome. Just a block from the what's called the Colosseum, they have dug down and found the setting of an early Christian church or a house church. So what you can imagine, that just a block from here, Christians could hear the screaming of the people for blood, and they were meeting in their little room to celebrate Holy Communion. You find first what's called the Basilica of San Clemente. You go into this basilica or this church, and on the street level, which is this level, the church dates back to about the 12th century. And then because the rubble of the city of Rome has gone up throughout the centuries, you go down one story below the street level, and there you come to like a 9th century church. And then what they've done is they, below this level, by the way, in this 9th century church, we have an example of a very early Christian baptismal font. And you notice it's maybe about 8 feet across. It has steps going down into it, so you would have walked down into the water, and I'm going to talk about that later. Wasn't deep enough to go all the way under. You probably stood in it up to about your waist, and then they would have poured the water over your head, possibly. Some of the frescoes that are in this 8th or 9th century. Okay, now you go down one more floor, and here's an alley. And when you get down to the floor, I just realized this slide's upside down. That's really the ceiling. That's the floor. So just pretend like you're upside down. But this is an alley, and what you have there, only it should be here, is the street level of first century Rome. Okay, right next to that street, and you feel like you're really down under the ground now. It's hard to imagine that this is the level of the first century. This is the Temple of Mithras, and this was a first century mystery religion. Or people that belonged to this religion to be initiated into the religion would stand here. They would kill bulls up on top here, and then the blood of those bulls would come down through these holes onto the people that were joining this religion. Now, just across that little alley is what is called the House of St. Clemens. And this is where a little group of persecuted Christians met and in this room would break bread and share the wine of the Holy Communion. Knowing that when they left they might be arrested, they knew what it meant to have the police or the soldiers come by their houses late at night and drag them out. But here they gathered to do what would cost them their life, and that was be baptized and worship Jesus. One can only stand there with a sense of awe when one realizes that 2,000 years ago, those who were baptized in Jesus here shared the bread and wine of Holy Communion. I think that's the last. Now, what I'd like to do now is describe to you what it was like to be baptized in, say, the second or third centuries. And these were the centuries when the Christian church was still illegal. It was against the law. And the reason was that Christians said Jesus is Lord, and they would not say the emperor is Lord. They refused to say Caesar is Lord, because they said we only have one Lord to worship, and that is Jesus. Okay, what if you wanted to become a Christian at that time? The first thing is you were received into the Christian community totally because of God's grace. You didn't have to be rich, you didn't have to be good looking, you didn't have to have any kind of status, you didn't have to be a certain race, it didn't matter if you were a child, an adult, man, woman, old, young, slave or free, you were received. Okay, now what do you do to prepare for your baptism? You go to classes for 3 years. Does that remind you of anything? Like confirmation? Only I'm sure it was different. But 3 years, and all you learned during those 3 years was the Christian way of life. How do Christians behave towards each other? That's what you learned all that time. And then after that instruction period, if you were ready then for baptism, your final instruction would be during Lent, which is now before our Easter. Okay, during the times of Lent, the first week of Lent, this is what the Christian community would do. They would try to talk you out of being baptized. They would say, count the cost. You would sit down before the Christian community, and they would just bombard you with this. Do you realize what it's going to cost you to be a Christian? Do you realize what you're going to have to give up to be a disciple of Jesus Christ? Do you realize the danger of being a Christian? Count the cost. Okay, if you passed that week and didn't drop out, can you imagine in our churches today when people come to join the church if we spend a week trying to talk them out of it? Ever thought of that? What if we'd say, well, we want you to spend a week counting the cost of being a disciple of Jesus Christ? Okay, that's the way it was. Then also during Lent, you would have what was called the first great exorcism. And the exorcism was this. Exorcism means casting the devil out of you. But it wasn't like giving you an exorcism. The Christian community would gather around you, and they'd all put their hands on you. They never had a lot of hands on their hands. Now you don't feel like something, you know, and they would pray then that evil would leave. Now what they meant by evil is this. Evil was to say the Roman government was God. Evil was to go to the Roman amphitheater and to worship violence and to enjoy violence. Evil was to go to the Roman circus and see chariot races and kill each other. And this was as tempting to those people as it is tempting for us to give up everything to be rich, to buy into the American way of life, but someday we can live in a big house and have a lot of cars. That is what they said, evil society holds you into. Okay, that was exorcism. Then just the week or the day before your baptism, and then your baptism would be Saturday night before Easter. So you would fast all day Thursday, all day Friday. That was Good Friday, the day of Jesus' death. And then you would fast all Saturday morning, afternoon, and then Saturday evening. Now you gather with the Christian community for your baptism. Now I want to tell you what went on for your baptism, because tell me what it's really that it happened to you if you ever did. First of all, again, the entire Christian community gathered around to put their hands on you. Pray. And then the next thing the priest did, the bishop and the pastor, they blew on you. Just blew. All around you, they blew and blew and blew. And this was to tell you that the breath of the Holy Spirit was coming in. It was
sign of the cross will be marked on your body to remind you that the identity of the rest of your life is to follow the way of Jesus' cross. You would always remember that that mark of the cross is that place of honor. Then the next ceremony was the opening of the ear for the bishop or whoever would pray prayer and accept his fingers in your ear. A lot of that was in the bedtime, probably just fell through it. And this is called the opening of the ears, and the bishop had his fingers in your ears and community with prayer. Your ears would always be open to hear the love of God. And then the next was called the opening of the doctrine, where the bishop would touch your nose. And if your nose was being touched, the prayer of the Christian community for you would be this. May you always smell the sweetness of the good news of God's love and Jesus Christ. May it always smell sweetness. Now the next thing, they understood that being baptized was to leave behind a way of darkness, and to move from that darkness into light. The darkness was always wet. The light was always easy. Why do you think they said that? All right, the sun rises in the east, the sun sets in the west, it's dark. So first, for the first part of the renunciation, they would stand and they would face the darkness of the west. And the bishop would say a word very close to this. You renounce the devil, all his work, all his way, all his tricks. And I even read that it came so specific that they would even say, you renounce the Roman chariotry. So then he would shout at the darkness. I renounce it. Just shout at the darkness. And he would turn. And then he would face the east where the sun rises, and they would say, you live in God the Father Almighty. And then you would say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, Creator of heaven and earth. You live in Jesus Christ. You live in the Holy Spirit. And facing the light, you would just shout to the light, yes, I believe. And then you would have oil for them. And they love the oil. And that's how it is. And the oil is a reminder that this is the Old Testament priests were ordained to be servants of God. You now become a priest of God. Everybody becomes a priest. And then think of it being about 11 o'clock at night by now. The rest of the night, the bishop reads long passages in the Old Testament. Hour after hour after hour. And these passages from the Old Testament were Old Testament places where you learn about that. And the bishop would tell you, he'd read about Noah's Ark, and he'd tell you your baptism is like Noah's Ark, you're going to go through the floods. He would read about Ezekiel and the dry bones coming to life. He would say your baptism is now going to be like your dead bones in the west, and now you're going to be living bones marching to the east. So that would go on through the hours of the night. Do you already have a picture that you'd really know you're baptized? Okay, and we're not even through yet. Okay, then the signal for the baptism now is the ancient alarm clock. What would that be? Anybody grow up on a farm? All right, the rooster crow. And then you would see the light start to break on the east. You would see the first sign of the dawn. And at that time, you would take all of your clothes off. And now the way they did this was that men would only be baptized with the men members of the congregation. They were modest. And women were only baptized with the women members of the congregation present. Why did you take your clothes off? Nothing. Jesus, and nothing was in the cross. He left everything behind us. He died on the cross. He was buried. Now you leave everything in your old way of life behind.
And then the sun is rising, the cock has crowed, and you go into the water of baptism. You walk down 3 steps, and you saw that on the one picture. You walk down 3 steps, you're back to the west. Walking down the 3 steps is a way of saying you're dying with Christ. And you're going down like into a grave, into a tomb. Flying into the water, and then you're baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Climb out of the water, walk up the 3 steps to remind you that as we read in the Romans chapter, you're being raised with Christ. And there the Christian community is waiting for you. And the first thing they do now after your baptism, they put you on a table. Remember now, you have no clothes. And they pour oil all over your body. And they gather around you and they rub. And they rub. And wouldn't that feel good? Just imagine an oil rub after your baptism. Okay, you're on that table. The reason they rub oil on you, this is what they did for athletes. You can run fast in a race. And everything, your Christian life is like you're an athlete and you're running. In order to run, you have to be ready. That's why they pour oil on you and rub you now. And then when you come off the table of the oil, the community is waiting there with a white robe. And they put the white robe upon you. And this robe says that your life now is covered with the forgiveness of Jesus. And in the book of Revelation, we have that scene of the thousands of the saints in heaven, and they all have a white robe. And the first readers knew what this was. It was their baptism. And then with your white robe, and you can imagine with all your brothers and sisters gathered around you, hey, if it were me, I'd only be with my brothers, but as soon as they get the robe on, I meet all my Christian sisters. And then in tremendous joy, I go to a place to do something I've never done before, to see something I've never seen in my life, and that is the Holy Communion. Because all the 3 years I was preparing for baptism, I was asked to leave before the Holy Communion. It was called the dismissal. So I've never seen a Holy Communion. And I enter into that room and we gather around a table. And there we share the bread and we share the wine. And I know that bread is the body of Jesus Christ. That wine is the blood of Jesus Christ, meaning Jesus is present with his family. Well, that was baptism. Okay, I want you to come now back to the 20th century. No, stay back there one more minute. There's one thing that you would not forget from your baptism, and that is you would have so much attention heaped on you at the time of your baptism that you would remember the whole rest of your life that I'm a worthy person. Can you imagine that? You're a slave. You're a slave, you're the lowest person in all society, and you'll probably maybe die on a cross yourselves because thousands of slaves died on crosses just for making some dumb mistake. You're a slave. You're considered a nobody. If you're a woman, you're really considered a nobody in that society. And you come out of that font of baptism and you are a wonderful, marvelous person in the family of God that is honored by your brothers and sisters in this new community. And you enter this community and it's a turned around community. The presiding minister might be a slave, and the person that comes to receive Holy Communion from the bishop might be his master out there in life. But here you're a great person. Okay, now I want to transfer you back. The very fundamental thing when we start remembering our baptism, and even if we were just a little baby, and they probably brought their babies with them into the water in those days, probably. Once you start thinking of your baptism and what it means, This is the powerful message that my self-worth is totally a gift. Because our society has all kinds of ways of telling you whether you're worthy or not. Just look in a magazine. Look at the advertising. You're worthy if you're beautiful. You're worthy if you're rich. Or think of your high school, maybe. You're worthy if you have a lot of personality. You're worthy if you achieve high grades. You're worthy if you do this or that or this. And if we believe that, that's like going to the Roman circus. If we believe that. And once I understand baptism, I can just say, like standing to the west, I can just say no to all of those other ways that say that I have to do that to be a worthy person. It is my baptism that tells me I'm okay and I'm worthy and I'm loved. And even at times when you don't feel like a Christian and feel like God is a million miles away, it's your baptism that tells you you're a Christian. Martin Luther used to get terribly depressed. He'd feel like God would never love him again. And he would just shout at that time, "I'm baptized. That's all I need." Okay, oh, I've gone. Is that the right time or is that off? It's right? Oh, good. Before our discussions, I want to show a movie, and I'm not going to say any more about this movie except it's a true story and is filmed in Mexico. It's about a little boy that had an accident, and the movie is entitled Baptism, Sacrament of Belonging. It's produced by the Franciscans in the Roman Catholic Church to try to teach us the meaning of baptism. And you'll notice it doesn't have a baptism in it, but it's called Baptism, Sacrament of Belonging. So look at the movie, and then in your family groups, we'll talk about the movie.